Good afternoon to everyone. On today's PPSC PDP call on Thursday the 6th of May, we have Jeff Newman, Alex Gakuru, Tatiana Kramsova, Paul Diaz, Alan Greenberg, David Maher, Wolf Ulrich Knoben. From staff, we have Margie Milam, Marika Konings, Glenda Sangeri, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. Avery Doria will be joining us shortly, and we have apologies from James Bladel. And please remind everyone to save their names for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Jeff.
Thank you very much. Good morning and good afternoon. This is Jeff Newman, chair of the Policy Development Process Work Team. It is May 6th, as was said, and this is our regularly scheduled meeting. I think on the agenda today, we have a couple of items. The first one is to finish the discussion on the thresholds, which I think we should be able to do in fairly short order. We're almost done. There's really just one question left that we would address on this call. Actually, there are two of them left. The second one, we don't really understand what it means, and actually Margie needs to go back, and we're not going to have a discussion on that one today. Margie's going to go back and see if she can get other insight as to what that means. The second item that we'll cover is an idea on how to deal with the issue of the bylaws and creating some sort of flow chart that Marika will talk about. And the third item is to look at the document that was sent around by Marika earlier this week on stages 1 through 5, but also, more importantly, for purposes of discussion today, to look at the executive summary where she has taken out the recommendations from the various places in the report, put them all up front. And there are a number of items that are, either to be determined or we don't have a recommendation yet. So we'll kind of cover a process for dealing with those going forward, all with the ultimate goal of getting an initial report out in time to have a discussion in Brussels and a discussion and a workshop in Brussels. So that said, are there any questions on the agenda? Okay, hearing none, the item that we need to talk about, which came up at the very end of the discussion last week, which is a bigger topic than we had time for, was the question of, if we look at the document on Adobe Now, and we scroll down to page, let me get you the exact page here, page 5, which, again, dealing with voting thresholds, and it's a statement that's currently in the bylaws that I believe people interpret differently. And it basically says that in any case in which the council is not able to reach GNSO supermajority vote, supermajority vote, a majority of the board will be sufficient to act. And we started the discussion last week that there are two different ways that people have been interpreting it. One camp has been interpreting it as, the board can act, the board can vote on something that didn't have supermajority vote, but in the event it doesn't have supermajority vote of the council, the board taking action, i.e. approving it, would not be sufficient enough for a consensus policy to be binding on contracted parties. There are others that take the view of interpreting this provision in the bylaws to say, no, the provision says in the case where it's not able to, there's no supermajority vote, the board could still act, and that would be binding on or would be considered a binding consensus policy within the meaning of the contracted parties' contracts. So I believe those are the two interpretations. Does anybody think there's a third interpretation of that? Okay, not seeing any hands. I think those are the two interpretations. And what I want to try to do is I want to go around and try to stimulate discussion and ask each person on this call, including Margie, I'm going to put you on the spot as well, to tell me what you personally believe the interpretation of that is so we can kind of get a sense of the group. And if you're not sure, then you say, I'm not sure. It could be read either way. I have no opinion. But if you do have an opinion on this, I'd really like to hear it. So I'm going to go in alphabetical order, in the order in which you appear in the meter. So, Alan, you're the lucky first one. How do you personally interpret that provision? Alan, are you on mute?
I forgot. Thank you.
Okay.
I interpret it as if the board approves the motion, which was approved by the GNSO, just not with a supermajority, that it has the power of consensus policy if it happens to be an issue that involves picket fence and consensus. The reason I interpret it that way is I can't get into the heads of the people who wrote this, I cannot fathom any other rationale for them putting the words in to explain why they're there, because otherwise we're saying the board can take action, but it has no meaning. And remember, at the time this was written, PDPs were pretty well only about consensus policy because the concept was brand new. And although it's since widened that a PDP may have may essentially give advice to the board on other issues, I think the concept of consensus policy was what they were talking about then. So I can't fathom any other reason for the words being there if it wasn't meant to imply it has the power of law, as it were.
Okay, well, let me ask you another question, right? On that, it says that in any case in which a council is not able to reach a GNSO supermajority vote, mm-hmm. Your interpretation was that the council has a majority vote.
Otherwise, it wouldn't have gone to the board, I would think. That was implied to me. If that needs to be clarified, I don't think there's a problem. But let's see. How does it start? The board will meet as soon as feasible after the receipt of the board report from the staff manager.
Is there, and maybe this question from RG, is there anything preventing GNSO council from sending something to the board that doesn't have a majority support?
No, okay, I'm not Margie, but the previous clause 12 says a successful GNS vote of the council members will be deemed to reflect the view of the council and may be conveyed to the board as the council's recommendation. So you only get there if there was a successful vote of the board, of the council.
Okay. All right, so your interpretation is then the second one that I had said, that because in your mind the words there would be kind of meaningless if it didn't have the power of law, as you called it, that your interpretation is that the board, if it passed it, then it would be binding on contracted parties as a consensus policy.
Yes, because the words say that if it's a supermajority of the GNSO, they can reject it. They can overwhelmingly reject it. But if it wasn't a supermajority, they can accept it with a majority of the board. So yes, I interpret it that way.
Okay, Alex, do you have a view on this?
My view is that I think whoever were writing this were trying to preempt a situation where there would be a hung council, and therefore then the board would come in and say, this is no supermajority. They would come in and then actually just make sure that certain policy goes through. So I do believe that it was trying to predict a situation where there might be a hung council, and so the board is then being empowered to, of course, and implement whatever policies have been developed. Of course, I go by the first assumption that in the first place there was a majority. There was a sort of majority in the council itself, just that it was no super majority. So my belief is that it's what they were trying to predict scenarios like those and take care of them. That's the opinion I have. Thanks.
So let me, and I'll get to David Maher, but let me ask a question as well. If all it requires is a majority then of the council, then why would we even break down supermajority for – why would we even have a definition of supermajority? Why does that matter?
Perhaps it is to stress the consensus. It is the more the supermajority of a policy would be, then perhaps the more it would have reflected more consensus. But where that consensus is not very visible, then the board would come in and trying to figure out whether maybe it's to the best interest of ICANN and all other factors, and then say yes, it's probably still a good policy. That's my view on that. Thanks.
Well, then, and then I'm going to go to Alan because he's got his hand raised. But then, wouldn't it seem like the board should have a higher threshold than a majority for a consensus policy? I'll go back to Alan.
I'll answer that question after, but I was addressing the original question of why the supermajority for council. And I think this is perhaps one of the very few places that the bylaws really embody the concept of a bottom-up organization, consensus-driven organization. It says if council overwhelmingly feels something, that something is appropriate, the board is going to have to be almost unanimous against it to defeat it. That essentially council recommending it, unless it's really, really stupid in the view of many, many directors, becomes, you know, to use the word I used before, not appropriately law. So I think that, again, one of the few places that it's really embodied in the bylaws. And I think that's an interesting, you know, measure.
Now the
question of shouldn't the board need a larger amount to overrule the weak approval of council, I could probably live with that and say the board needs a supermajority or something else. That I think is a valid subject for debate.
Okay, so let me go to David Maher. Do you share Alan and Alex's view, or do you have a different view?
I just got off mute. I was about to say, I think I'm not sure what it means. I mean, you can make good arguments, and I hear those arguments, but it's bad drafting, and it needs to be fixed.
And so as a contracted party, how do you think, what should it be? In other words, should the board, so let's say there's, let me point to an example. Let's say all of the non-contracted parties vote in favor of a policy, and they manage to convince the one nominating committee member on the contracted party side. So now you have a majority of the council that votes in favor of something, but not a supermajority.
Well,
actually, I'm sorry. Wait, no.
I'm wrong.
Let me restate it. Sorry, I caught myself. Majority vote is a majority of each house.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So you have a majority of the contracted parties vote in favor of it, a majority of the non-contracted parties vote in favor of it, but it does not amount to a supermajority. As a contracted party in which your contract says needs to be consensus in order to be binding, you have a particular view on that. Should a majority be enough for the board to actually act by a majority? If the answer is yes, then
no.
Should it be a higher threshold for the board? So what's your thoughts on that?
Should be a higher threshold.
Higher threshold for the council and the board, or?
Yes, for both.
And why is that?
Well, these are critical issues, and interfering with the contract, there has to be some overriding public interest issue that has gotten supermajority support. Otherwise, seems to me the whole idea of the contract is very much weakened.
So, and then to bring up the points of Alan and Alex, then. So, what you said is you think it's poor drafting Is that it?
I mean, well, the fact that we're having this discussion means that there are ambiguities, and it's important that they be fixed.
What about taking the interpretation that, you know, could it mean that the board could act, but, you know, it may be more, could it be more advisory or best practice in nature as opposed to a binding consensus policy? Is that one interpretation?
Well, sure. But we don't want to have a variety of interpretations on something this important. It ought to be clear.
Okay. Let me go to Paul. You're next. How do you view this provision?
Well, thanks, Jeff. I agree with David. I think I agree with Alan and Alex as well, that the clarity is necessary. Ambiguity is a bad thing in the bylaws. You want, you know, people to clearly understand what is intended and how the processes are supposed to work. And I definitely agree with David that some threshold greater than a simple majority of the board should be necessary, if only a majority, that is not a supermajority, in favor came out of council. That shows that there's not enough, or, you know, that supermajority level of support, that alone should say a lot to the board, and I think would impact its voting. But I think we need to clarify here that the threshold at the board level needs to explicitly be set higher.
Okay. Alan?
Just quickly, different people are answering different questions. For instance, David made it clear that, yes, there is ambiguity, and that is a bad thing in bylaws. Actually, ambiguity in bylaws is often quite deliberate. I think in this particular clause, there shouldn't be any. But, you know, very often one gives latitude to a board by having things being ambiguous.
There's no ambiguity in the bylaws I draft.
I have drafted ones where they were deliberately ambiguous in some cases.
Okay.
But the question I answered, first of all, for instance, which David did not and some of the other people did not, is what do you think the drafters meant? Now, that's not everyone feels comfortable in making that guess. But we have two choices. We can either change the intent, which is within our rights at this point and our responsibilities, or we can consciously say, well, we think it meant something and we need to draft it clearer. And perhaps we have to explore that as we go along.
Okay, but you did give your opinion as to what it should be as well. I mean, right?
I did, but I note as we've gone through it, not everyone has, and they may not feel comfortable, and that's fine.
Right.
I'm just pointing it out.
Okay. So let me, Tatiana, do you have any thoughts on this?
I'm on mute, I'm sorry, no.
No, okay. And that's fine. Let's see who else is on. Wolf.
That's me, yes, Wolf speaking. So, well, to fully understand, so I'm not so too much familiar with all the bylaws in this respect, but just one question, and I have later on another question. So in which cases this situation may arise? So does it come from, you know, the council? I understand the council is going to submit a PDP to the board, in which case, after voting on a majority basis or voting on two-thirds per house basis or voting on supermajority basis. So that's my question on with regards to that situation, to understand that. Because now it's written in any case in which the council is not able to reach genus or supermajority vote. So it could mean, okay, any case means, okay, if there is only one vote in favor, that's any case. It's also any case if it's supermajority vote minus one. So in that between. So that's for me critical, I think. So then depending on that, I would say, so at least the board should have should follow this threshold, which is necessary to submit the PDP to him. So that's I'm not sure about that. I would say so because I'm not from the contracting side. I would say okay, the board how I see the board is okay. He should have the right well to overrule the GNSO to some extent. So, but depending on what was happening before. So, and then I have to understand what was happening here before in total.
Okay, so a couple things. Number one is I think everyone's saying, and Avery has joined too. So, Avery, I don't know how much of the discussion you've heard.
None. I just heard the very end of what Knauman was saying.
Okay, so let me summarize and then get your thoughts because I've actually gone down the list and getting everyone's thoughts. So we're talking about the provision that says that in any case in which the council is not able to reach GNSO supermajority vote, a majority vote of the board would be sufficient to act. And the options that we discussed at the beginning of the discussion, you know, there have been two different ways that people have been interpreting it. The first way is that, let me go back before that. Everyone on this call agrees that the clause is completely ambiguous and that clarity is needed. Whatever the right or our recommended interpretation is, it needs to be clarified. The second point that we've been assuming, which isn't stated in E, is that the in any case part in which the council is not able to reach GNSO's supermajority vote, the assumption is that means it has to at least have a majority of the council in order to get to the board in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So that assumption may need to be explicitly stated. So assuming it's got majority support of the GNSO council, as majority is defined, it's a majority of each house or both houses. So assuming it's got majority but not necessarily supermajority, and assuming it goes to the board, the two interpretations are, on the one side, and Alan and Alex have expressed views this way, that they believe that means that the board could take action and that would be a binding consensus policy on contracted parties.
Mm-hmm.
And but did leave open the discussion let me go back a sec. So the second interpretation is that no, it would not be binding consensus policy. It may be advisory or best practice in nature if the board were to take action, but it's not a binding consensus policy. Otherwise, you know, then what's the difference between why would you have a majority or supermajority? Although Alan had answered that question of saying, Alex said, you know, look, it's really, if it's got supermajority of the vote of the council, then it takes essentially a supermajority of the board to not approve it, or it takes a really good reason and it goes through this other process. The question that also came up, the issue is that if it does mean a majority of the council is sufficient, then should it be a higher threshold of the board to declare something as consensus and binding? So that's a lot of questions, Avery.
Yeah, no.
But just to give you a flavor of what we talked about, and we've been going down the list to hear people's thoughts. So what are your thoughts on all of that?
First of all, on it being ambiguous, while I must confess I hadn't thought it was ambiguous because I had understood it, obviously the different interpretations mean, of course, it was ambiguous. So I guess I agree with you on that one. Is the board decision meant to be binding? I mean, on the next question, does it take a majority to get there? Yes, it does take it has to be successful. It takes a majority, and yeah, that should probably be stated explicitly, just so there's no further confusion about it. I had always thought that once the board voted on it, that it was at the end of the PDP in the same way as if it had gone there and with the supermajority where it could only be knocked down, didn't need to be approved, and thus, yes, I always assumed that it would be binding with that majority vote. And I think on the final question, is it reasonable to think about requiring more than a final vote, I mean more than a majority vote by the board to make something binding that, you know, did not succeed in the council? I'm not absolutely positive that I agree, but it's certainly worth considering. Did I answer all the questions?
Yeah, I think you definitely did.
Okay.
So I think, and not surprisingly, I think the way it's kind of come out, at least with the small group we have on now, and it wouldn't surprise me if this is the way it would turn out with a larger group, although we will certainly put the issue out to the larger group, is that the contracted parties on the call take the first approach, everyone agrees clarity is needed, everyone agrees that it should at least have a majority vote of the council in order to even get to the board. I think it breaks down that the contracted parties believe that it would not be binding, that the board could take action, you know, could approve it, but it would be a, advisory, best practice, whatever in nature. The non-contracted parties believe that it would be binding, otherwise, and it would have the same effect as if it was a supermajority of the council. But everyone on the call is open to the discussion of whether it should be a higher threshold of the board in order to, if it were interpreted in the second way, which, again, is not surprising and probably how everyone would have predicted that this would come out. I'm not sure that let me ask the question of the contracted parties. If we did this as, just again, this is kind of informal, not to put you on the spot, but if we said that it would be a majority of the council but require a supermajority of the board, would that, David or Paul, change your view as to whether you think it could be binding on the contracted parties or binding consensus policy?
You're saying that there would be a majority of the board.
No, the majority of the council.
Majority of the council, and then a supermajority of the board.
Right.
The board should have the ultimate power. I could live with that, I think.
Okay. Paul?
Yeah, Jeff, I agree with David, and that's what I was trying to communicate earlier. I think if there is a majority in both houses of the council, and then it goes to the board, as long as the supermajority threshold is explicitly stated, that the board can make that decision, and it would then be binding on all parties.
So Alex has agreed with that. Alan, is that Alan and Avery? Is that something as kind of a compromise? Avery agrees with that. Alan, you have a comment on that?
I'm quite happy with that. I just like to reiterate one thing which you didn't mention in your summary, but I think it's an important issue. If the original intent was not that it has the power of a consensus policy, then it comes down to, as you've been saying, a best practice or something. In general, one doesn't give boards powers to say what makes you a nice guy. And I know for registries, best practices have some legal implications because of safe harbors. But in general, it says you're a nice guy and we'd like you to do that. Boards don't normally pass motions like that. So I think to some extent going back to the intent reinforces what we're now, the conclusion that we may now be coming to with a large consensus, if not a unanimous one, that is the board has the ability to make it a consensus. Now the investors were quibbling over the numbers,
right? And I think you're right with respect to corporate boards. I think with respect to oversight bodies of policy organizations, I think it is not that unusual to have the whatever the equivalent of the board is, although it's not a corporation. But I think it is common to have management committees or, you know, in the IETF, it's the IESG, you know, making, even for best practices, you know, RFCs that are informational in basis, right? I think it is, it's not uncommon to have them approve of something.
Just for the record, the C in our name is corporation.
That's what I'm saying. I agree with you with respect to corporations. That's generally true. So what I'm hearing, though, is good in that it seems like we do have a recommendation, that it seems like, you know, a number of and Margie, please weigh in if you have comments on
it. She's been trying to. She's just polite.
It's because of this list. Doesn't allow you to see everybody at once because it's small.
Okay.
I was scrolled down to view everybody else, and I saw Marika. Never mind, Margie. Yes, please go on.
But sorry. Jeff, hands always rise to the top. You really don't have to look past that unless you're curious who else is on.
Well, I was actually polling everybody individually, going down the list, right? And thank you, Marika. I think you're making it, or whoever's making it. Thank you for me. Sorry, Margie. Please go on.
Yeah, okay. Actually, I have a different take on this because I view the contract analysis different than the bylaws analysis. And so the way that at least the bylaws look to me as I read them, you know, it talks about what the board can approve and what the thresholds, you know, that for something to being sent up to the board. And I do agree with Jeff in that there's different recommendations that can come up. There could be best practices. There could be an advisory. There could be all sorts of things that don't necessarily even have contract implications. And so that's why I see that that these provisions might apply to that situation. But even if your bylaws had the language that, you know, if it's inconsistent with the contracts, you've got to look at the contracts as well. I mean, there's two-part analysis that you do when you're trying to determine whether something's binding on a contracted party. And I think that even if there was a board vote, if there was not compliance with the contract, you have to look at the contract. So I don't, you know, I don't think that whatever we do in the bylaws could trump what's in the contract. I think the way that at least I've seen us look at it, is it's always, are we in compliance with the bylaws, yes or no, and then that's one analysis, and then what do the contracts say? And so that's why it doesn't seem as clear to me, and I think it would be useful to have clarity on the kinds of things that could go up to the board and that, you know, could have board approval even if there wasn't a supermajority in the council. And then the other thing I wanted to point out, too, is that when we talk about supermajority in the council, I think we're talking about that other threshold. It's not majority of each house. It's majority of each house plus 3 out of 4 stakeholder, you know, representatives proven, you know, in favor of the decision. Does that make sense?
Correct, yes. So I think you added another element that I guess we weren't considering, which is that you could have a case where it's a majority of the council using that threshold and a majority of the board being sufficient to act, where it's a PDP that doesn't necessarily recommend consensus policies. That may be enough. But if it does have something that's going to be a consensus policy, that what the people on the call are saying is that they'd be okay with having a supermajority of the board acting on that. So it's almost a bifurcation of that part. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's an added complication, but I think I think people here are coming together on that, and that would have clarity. Aubrey?
Yeah, on that point, I mean, I see that, although I think I would recommend against trying to bifurcate it and say, if it's a PDP to do with consensus quality, then you need the 3/4 or the 2/3 supermajority. If you don't, however, it starts to get really confusing. And I think that in terms of the parallel of if there's supermajority, then there's one policy. If there's not a majority, then a supermajority is required. I think, you know, the sort of, because that other rule of
you need supermajority to knock down a supermajority rule is not also not bifurcated for if it's consensus policy versus not. So I think that, you know, even though it does require a higher threshold on the board, you know, I don't see the harm in it. And it would have to be really a critical issue to see the board split down a majority anyway.
Yeah, I mean, most of the things the board votes on, I can't remember the last time it wasn't unanimous or pretty close to unanimous.
Right, they don't bring it to a vote if they don't have supermajority.
True. There have been a couple exceptions, but for the most part, that's definitely true. Alan?
Yeah, I certainly agree with Avery. I wouldn't want to see bifurcation that for one kind of policy, a different vote is needed than for the other. I think there are words in the bylaws right now about things like, and within Annex A, on a consensus position. I don't know if the word consensus policy is ever used. I haven't done a full scan. But I think in the end we need words that says this is how ICANN adopts a consensus policy, almost defining the term so that there is no question. Because right now we say these are consensus positions. Well, is a consensus position that's adopted by everybody a consensus policy? I would think if not, then we have some rather awkward explaining to do, but I think we need to make it clear in the final document.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of awkwardness, and especially because the registries and registrars have a different have different provisions in their contract. The registrars as we talked about, this two-thirds requirement, and the registries just have a generic statement in there referring to the bylaws, but making it clear that it has to be a consensus, however that's defined.
Yeah, but we can't fix the registrar one unless the contract terms are fixed. Right now, the registrar one says even on the negotiated parts of the contract, you still need the two-thirds vote of counsel, effectively a rubber stamp. That has to be fixed, but it's not within our power to do that.
Right. So we kind of have to basically make do with what we've got. And Margie, is your hand still up on something different? Or is that the old?
I forgot to take it down, sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. So I think, so what I'm hearing from Aubrey and Alan is we shouldn't necessarily bifurcate that into, you know, whether it's a consensus policy or not. But in either case, if it's a majority of the council but not supermajority, that it should be a supermajority of the board Act, although Alan also has made the comment, which I'm not sure if anyone would disagree with, is that really there should be some clarity in the bylaws as to what would constitute a consensus policy. So we'll have to think about how to handle that one. All right, any other discussion on this, on E? Okay, good. So then I want to jump – we've kind of finished the threshold discussion for now. There is an F in the in this threshold discussion, which I think we briefly mentioned the last time, which I don't think anyone on this call really understood what it meant, which is when the final decision on a council recommendation or supplemental recommendation is timely, the board shall take a preliminary vote and, where practical, will publish a tentative decision that allows for a 10-day period – a public comment prior to a final decision by the board. We don't really remember, or Aubrey, have your hand up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say what I understood that timely to mean, and what I under timely to mean was time critical, and that's the way I've always read it, and maybe that is a meaning of timely in some law book somewhere. I don't know because I'm not a lawyer, but I've always read it as if it's time critical.
Okay, that's certainly a good interpretation. Wolf, do you have a comment, and then Wolf?
Yeah, sorry, the phone dropped. Basically the same as Avery. I read it as, you know, if I were to draft it, I would use different words. You know, if the board deems an urgent to be time-sensitive and urgent, instead of just the word timely,
I would give it more specificity and say who decides whether it's timely. But that's what I think it means.
So you said the board considers it time critical. Is it the board or is it the council?
No, it's the board that's deciding to bypass the normal posting and wait procedure. That can be recommended by the council, but I think it's a board decision. I mean, at some point, boards do have to make decisions.
Okay, Wolf?
And it could have become critical after it left the hands of council.
Okay, Wolf?
Yeah, okay, thanks. Well, it's more a question, before we leave the threshold discussion, if I may, a question with regard to a supermajority vote, my understanding, since I missed the last meeting. So we have, a definition for a supermajority vote, which means there may be different cases with regards to, or different results with regards to genus or supermajority vote. Is that correct? On page 7, I think, so I refer to that. So we have defined either 2/3 of council members of each house or 75% plus a majority of the other part of the other part of the house. Is that my understanding of the definition of supermajority? The correct?
Sorry, I put myself on mute. I meant, yes. Yeah, that's correct.
So that means, to my understanding, so that could lead to, and if you look at the number of votes on council, that could lead at the end to different results. So either on if you sum up the both houses, so it could result if you looked for 2/3 of each house. That would result in 14 votes. And if you look for the other case, the 75% and plus the 50%, in one case, it could lead to 14 votes necessary, and the other case to 13 votes only. Is that the understanding of all of us?
Well, it's hard to look at it in terms of number of people because the contract...
Yes.
The contracted parties only have seven council members.
Yes, I understand.
Right? So you have to have 75% for supermajority, you have to have 75% of one house, which could be either,
yes.
Right? So you do have the different numbers, but I think I'm trying to understand your question.
No, it is, just to make it clear. So if you takes this rule 75% of one house and a majority of the other house, it means. So 75% for the contracting party house is 6 votes. And the majority of the other house is 7 votes. That means 6 plus 7 means 13. In the other case, if you look for a supermajority of the non-contracted party house, that means 10 votes. And the majority of the other house of the contracted party is 4 votes. That means 14 in result. So it must. I just would like to know that, so that is that to make that transparent and clear. And if that is the understanding and if that is agreed, then it's okay.
Yeah, I think in your example it sounds like it's a 1 vote difference, but it's not really. It could be. In other words, you could have for a majority. You could have a number of situations where it's a majority but not supermajority, which would result in a bigger difference of whether it's 1 vote. But in your example, that's right.
Yeah. Jeff, it's Alan. Can I try to...
No, that's the threshold. I'm talking about the threshold.
Right. So yeah, Alan, yeah?
Yeah. Although it's a forbidden word, the split in council with a different number of seats per house essentially has given a different weight to the votes on the two sides. They're not calculated as weights. I think if in their wisdom the board had decided that there were 3 councillors on the contracted parties stakeholder group and 300 on the non-contracted parties. Clearly, the number of votes that we would see, that is, hands up, that we would see in each of these thresholds would be radically different.
Yeah.
And that's why we went to count the houses as percentages of each house and not count votes. So, mm-hmm. you know, the fact that there only are 6 and 12 makes the numbers very close. If the imbalance in number of councillors was much larger, which it could have been in a different mm-hmm. model, then the vote numbers would be radically different based on the different percentages, but it still passes because of percentages of houses.
Okay, good.
Thank you, Alan. You explained it a lot better than I could have. So, Wolf, did you have another point, or is that...
No, thank you. So.
Okay. Alex?
Yes, I'm commenting on point bullet F, and I'm focusing on the second part, the or supplementary recommendation is timely. And I think on a previous call, somebody spoke of situations where the board may want to test maybe what the community thinks of something because of supplementary recommendation that may have come, not necessarily a GNSO council recommendation or development post a certain policy has been put in. I don't know whether it was Maggie, and I wanted maybe us to revisit that bit why they need the 10 days for public comment. Is it what are the circumstances under which the board requires those 10 days to inform what? Maybe then that we can understand what bullet F really means and see whatever rephrasing may be necessary, if at all it is. Thank you.
So the supplemental recommendation is, just to remind everyone, that is where the board has rejected a consensus policy recommendation. Where the board has rejected a council position. If the board determines that a recommendation is not in the best interest of ICANN, the IK community, or ICANN, it'll send it back to the council. And the council will, in a form of a board statement, so it's articulating the reasons, and then the council will have that for discussion, the board statement, and the council will then meet to either affirm or modify its recommendation and communicate that conclusion to the board. So the board rejects it, states its reasons. The council can say, okay, well, here's how we address your concerns and modify its recommendation, or it could just say, we hear your concerns, board, but we still really feel strongly this is the way to go, and so this is our recommendation that you adopted as is. That's the supplemental recommendation. Your question is, what is the purpose of the 10-day comment period? You know, how is that being used? And I think it's basically...
Yes, absolutely. Sorry, I was on mute. Yes, I want to understand the 10 days and in relation to what was going on there. Thanks.
Right. So if it's a supplemental or a regular, then but it's time-sensitive, which I think is the interpretation that Alan and Avery have given the word timely. So if it's time-sensitive, determined by the board, maybe recommended by the council, the board shall take a preliminary vote and, where practicable, publish a decision that allows for 10-day public comment period. So the board can informally, I guess, discuss it amongst the board, say, okay, here's what we think of we're going to do, but we want to put it out for a comment period to see if we're on the right path, I think is basically what it is. But, Alan, do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure it's a comment. It's amazing how you can read these things so many times and then suddenly see it differently. I have a question. What's the path that is followed at this point if it's not timely, whatever timely means?
Well, if it's not time-sensitive, my guess is that it just goes to the board as...
Who can simply take a vote and not ask for public comment. So if it's time-sensitive, we delay the process. If it's not time-sensitive, we can act immediately. That's my confusion. There normally is a public comment period associated with the board voting on a PDP. My recollection is, but I'm not sure, that the board normally calls for a public comment period after the PDP is presented as a fait accompli and before the board votes, I think.
Correct.
I don't think there's normally a comment period after the board votes to approve it. But I may be wrong on that because these comment periods seem to pop up with some regularity. Maybe staff can clarify this because it's only talking about this process in times where, and we're interpreting it as being urgent, and it sounds like for really urgent things, the board can't act immediately. For not urgent things, the board can act immediately. Something's not parsing here.
So let me cut off this discussion with the same way we kind of started it, which is, Margie, if you could go back to staff and see what, we've obviously had a discussion here of the different ways it can be interpreted. If you could go seek some clarification on that, and then I'd like to actually move on to the next subject. But, Margie, do you have a closing kind of remark?
Yeah, I mean, I keep staring at it and coming up with not with blanks, so I will will definitely follow up and get information on what that was intended to apply to.
Okay.
How many years has that been there and no one's questioned it?
Yeah, I don't have information that's helpful. I will follow up.
And I'm one who helped draft it, and I can't remember. Which I guess is pretty sad. although I admit it was like at least six years ago, so time has faded.
You didn't focus on just that one paragraph.
No. So anyway, let's move on. Then the second item that I wanted to discuss, and Marika, I'm going to turn it over to you, is a kind of a way forward with respect to how to deal with the bylaws issue, at least in our initial report. And, Marika, do you want to kind of discuss what we talked about earlier?
Yeah. So this is Marika. You've all received a copy of an updated version of the report, and we discussed last week that, and I think everyone agreed that our goal should be to have something for community discussion and review in Brussels. That puts us at a 31st of May deadline. So I think we'll talk about the report and the recommendations next. But one issue that we would like to include in the report, and of course will be a crucial focal point for the community, is what does this group recommend in relation to changes to the bylaws? So initially we're working, and that's what we did throughout the report, take the relevant sections from Annex A and provide some red lines as to, the discussions we had and where we had some agreements on changes to be made. But, having had a closer look at the overall bylaws and taking into account that, the shift from the task force model to the working group model, there are many provisions that are basically obsolete and no longer relevant, as well as certain parts that are not being used. And, we've discussed as well that there's some elements that, are really not clear. And as well, of course, we're moving towards a whole new model of how we want to conduct the PDP, even though some elements might still be the same. So our proposal would be in order to get something that the community can look at that will give a good idea of where the group is moving towards, is instead of having a red line or very, word by word what the new bylaws will look like, have more of a kind of a flow chart model in which we'll outline the different phases and steps of the new PDP with different elements that we have identified and where we have agreement on, which are also, of course, modeled on the recommendations that are in the report, and use that as a way of saying, look, this is the broad outline or the broad strokes of the new bylaw model that we're looking at. And we first want to get your input from the community to see if we're, are we moving along the right track? Do you see these elements as being part of the new bylaws? We also need to have a discussion which elements, of course, go in the bylaws and which should go in the rules of procedures. By using that as a way of shaping the discussion and trying to visualize for the community in which direction this group is working, and then following community discussion and public comment, come back, look again at our recommendations, finalize those, and then translate those into actual bylaw language and, do the more legal analysis of how to phrase certain things and decide on which elements should go in bylaws and which elements should move into rules of procedure. So So that's the suggestion we wanted to put up for discussion. Let's see, Avery, you have your hand raised?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, thanks, Marika. I was on mute, but yes.
Oh, okay. I think the idea of having a flow chart is ideal. And in fact, I must say that the whole time I operated this chair, I had a flow chart that I think had been prepared by Olaf on how the PDP worked. And while I had read the bylaws many times, that flow chart was you know, biblical in proportions. I do think, however, that we might want to have, in addition to that, you know, the idea of where the bylaws language is going, because a flow chart in itself, while it gives a good indicator of the flow and the thing, it doesn't necessarily explain what's in the box. And so a flow chart, while totally necessary and great, might not be enough by itself, but I think having the flow chart is a great idea, but I think it'll need more. Thanks.
Yeah, and I think the flow chart, I mean, I'll need to think a bit about how to indeed put that on paper, but I think the idea would be, for example, that in the flow chart, you know, we make as well bullet points of the you know, crucial elements of each stage, and we could work, for example, with, you know, coloring those, like red elements are, you know, a must in the bylaws. Orange, you know, we're not sure, might be in the bylaws, might be in the rules of procedures. Green, you know, we think those should go in the rules of procedures. We can, you know, think of different ways of trying to do that in a way that it's, you know, we get all the elements into one document and still might make it understandable for, you know, community as a whole without having to read our, although they probably should, you know, read the 150-page document.
Okay.
Alan?
Sorry, yeah, I am off mute. I had to check.
Sorry.
That's okay. Alan?
Yeah, maybe I took this in a different way. I took what Marika was saying as that's what we're going to do, that's what we should try to do for Brussels. And although I think a flowchart is a useful tool, I don't think that we can enact our policy as a flowchart. But I also think it's ludicrous to think that we're going to end up with bylaw wording that this group has generally agreed to, you know, suggested bylaw wording this group has agreed to in time to publish for Brussels. So I think a flowchart is an ideal way of representing where our ideas are going right now, given that there's no opportunity to do it in a firmer way anyway, and it's probably easier to visualize as the flowchart. So as a long-term aid and as the short-term only way we can present it in Brussels, I support.
Yes, and that's the idea. Of course, at the end of the day, we need to have, you know, the firm language. But, you know, as you said, I don't think we'll get that before Brussels. And I think we need, you know, some further discussion. And I think partly as well as we had, you know, limited participation in this group, I think it might be a good testing ground as well to put this out in the community and hopefully get some, you know, green ticks and saying, yes, you know, you're moving along the right direction, we're happy with what you're doing. So that, you know, if we put all that effort in getting bylaws written and then people come back and saying, oh, you know, but we really didn't agree and didn't like it, now at least we can, you know, put a stick in the sand and say, look, do you like where things are moving? And, you know, we take that as a green light then in you know, finalizing our work following Brussels, hopefully.
Yeah, I this is Jeff. I do think it'll be very helpful to have that. And, you know, a lot of people are visual in nature, and seeing that in a chart will certainly be a useful tool for them. I am visual in nature as well, so that it certainly helps me. Any other questions or comments on the notion of the flowchart? Okay, so I'm sorry, Alan,
No, sorry, just hadn't put it down.
Okay, and Aubrey has the check mark, so she's agreeing with whatever I say, no matter what it is.
Got it, always.
on the third item on the agenda is talking about what, and Marika's going to walk through it, what we decided on the last call was because it's 150 pages or whatever it is, And also kind of consistent with what we talked about when we were talking about what should be in our report, is really to take the recommendations and put it up front in the executive summary so people don't necessarily have to read the whole 150 pages. In order to get the context, they may have to, but so they could see the recommendations up front and in an executive summary. So given that, and also that it's helpful for us to figure out the work that we need to do, Marika has taken out the recommendations from the different places in the report, put it all up front in the executive summary, and as you can see, if you scroll through it, there are a number of highlighted yellow, to be determined, to be decided questions that we'd like to fill in before we submit this report. And when I say fill in, it doesn't necessarily have to mean here's the concrete recommendation that we have to do. In other words, this is the one answer. Now, we don't have to do that, but what we should do is say, here are the options, and even though we don't necessarily have consensus yet in our group as to what the right answer is, here are the potential answers, and we're seeking your feedback on that. So I'm assuming everyone's still there except for one.
I can still hear you.
Everyone else still here? So I hear Avery. Anyone? I was going to say anyone.
It's okay, Jeff.
What's that?
I'm on myself. All right.
Alan disconnected.
Okay, yeah, Alan did say he needed to make another call and be back in a minute. So I'm assuming that's what happened. Okay, so with that, our approach is really that we need to, and there's a number of them, there's 20-something of them that still have this yellow highlighted that need to be decided. That means a lot of work in a very short period of time. What we are going to do is we are going to, I'll ask your opinion on this. The recommendation is that we basically send around these issues in a separate email, copying and making breaking it down into a logical number of them so we don't get overwhelmed with all of these. So maybe take for the next call the first five or six, send around an email by Tuesday that has the relevant portion of the discussion that's in the main document so that people could see that, and then gathering thoughts as to what the recommendation should be, and then talk about that on the next call so that by the by the 15th or, by the 30th, we could have those filled in with some sort of recommendation. Again, the recommendation could be, we've talked about A, B, or C options. We're seeking your feedback as to which one we should adopt. Does that make sense? Anyone have any comments on that? Marika?
Yeah, it is, Marika. I just have a question. Do you only want to focus on those that are yellow and assume that people are reviewing those where there is language?
That is my assumption, since the others are taken directly from the report, which in theory should have been reviewed already, or you have until the 15th to review. So it's not precluding comments on those. It's just spending our time working on the ones in yellow. Now, it could be after people do get around to putting comments by the 15th that one of these could become a yellow one. But at this point in time, the assumption is let's just focus on the yellow ones. And I'm seeing agreement. Marika?
Yeah, there's one point I actually realized earlier today looking at this document, that if you look at stage one, we've called it planning and initiation. And stage two, we've also called it initiation of the policy development process. And I was just wondering if it would make more sense to say planning and request of the issues report, to make sure, because we've been talking about this before, of not having this confusion, and I just want to make sure that if the group is okay with that, that I can change it throughout the document, because I think it might otherwise cause confusion.
Well, I think that recommendation makes sense. Does anyone disagree with that recommendation? Since it does accurately reflect what's in that relevant section. So why don't we do that? Okay. So Marika, I think you said that there were, on the pre-call, there's 20-something of 23, maybe 24 of these yellow ones?
Yeah. Yeah, I think there are 23. I think some of those have some suggested language that, I think I wrote on the basis of the discussion. So it's a mix where there's really a few of those where there's really nothing, and some there is, some suggestion, but it definitely needs a further review and input from the group.
So I think we'd like to, if we're planning ahead, it would be great to have to post this by the 30th, which means that we have 3 more meetings before that time period. So if we can, if you can go through and logically break it down into 3 groups, which may mean equal numbers in each one of them, or it may not be, depending on how dense the question is, right? It could be a real serious topic that may take longer. If you could just go back and maybe figure out a logical way to divide that up into 3 different sessions, that hopefully will make sense, so we could discuss it on 3 next calls.
Yeah, I think that shouldn't be a problem. A question I would have, though, would the group like that I, put some suggestions on? I'm just worried that, if I send out a document and no one responds, or no one puts forward options, we won't get done in time. So I'm just wondering if are people happy if I just put down some bullet points for, based on the discussion and the things that are in our discussion as options for consideration, that people can comment on that or add to that? Or what does the group think would be most productive in trying to get indeed language out there that people can comment on or rewrite or edit?
So when you break this down into 3 logical groups, you're also going to put in the email the – sorry, my voice is going. In the email, you're also going to put the reference or the actual section, the discussion from the section. But I do think, and Alex seems to agree, I don't think it hurts to put down some thoughts that you have on the options, and that may help steer the conversation.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments on that? So I think that's kind of going to be our approach. I do absolutely want comments from everyone on everything in the 5 stages, by the 15th, May 15th, putting aside that this part of the discussion will not be done by then. But, we do really want to get this preliminary or this initial report out by the 30th or, June 1st or whatever the deadline is to get the documents out. Before Brussels. So if we have comments in by May 15th, that'll give us enough time to look at that, revise the reports, revise the sections, and then put the report out. Do we have, Marika, sorry, you have another comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out as well that I've added as well some other language. For example, there's as well an introduction in the executive summary that explains a bit, the responsibilities of the group, and as well the fact that, we haven't gone through everything, but this is a way of getting input. I've provided some updates as well to Section 2, where we, describe the approach we've taken. I think in the one of the annex, we have the background on, the GNSO improvements process and the mission of this group and how it's been formed. I think there's as well on the working group, I've added a column on meetings attended, so we can reflect that as well in the document. So those are other elements where I hope that the members of the group will look at and provide comments or input if they don't agree with the approach. And then, of course, the idea is as well to plug in the document on the overarching issues and put in the notes there. I probably need to rework it a bit, the layout, to put that in, I think, in Section 8. And then in Section 9, we would eventually have, the flowchart bylaw document that we'll be working on in the coming weeks.
Great. Thank you, Marika. I think I know I certainly do, and I'm sure the group definitely appreciates all the work you've done on this. I think this is there are unlike any other group I've been in, the amount of issues that we've had to tackle has just been enormous. And I know it's taken a long time, and there may be some that are that have stopped showing up to these calls in frustration, but I really do think that we have made a lot of progress, and in the end will be some really beneficial recommendations coming out of this group. That said, before we adjourn the call, is there anyone on here? I don't know if Glenn is on, or do we know what day the workshop will be, and if we finalize the days of our meeting? I know that the vertical integration group is recommending, is requesting a fairly big block of time on Saturday or Sunday, and I'm not sure if that changes things with respect to our meeting.
Hi, Jeff. This is Glenn. Yes, I am aware of that, and I think that maybe we might have to get an extra room and run it in parallel. I'm waiting to hear from Stefan, not in parallel with the PPSC, PDP, and work group, as we said on Sunday, but perhaps on Saturday we might have to run it in parallel with something. Then, of course, there is a huge question mark that Kurt's time is not yet secured. So we might have to change everything if Kurt tells us that he can do his GTLDs on Sunday instead of Saturday.
Yeah, I think there are a couple things that we certainly don't want to conflict with, because I think there are a number of people in this group. So, for example, there are a number of people in this group that are on the vertical integration one.
Yes.
So I'm not. So it would be difficult to have a conflict with that. And, you know, obviously new GTLDs is a big item. So we wouldn't want to conflict with that. So I think everyone in this group that's planning on attending Brussels should plan on being there on Saturday anyway. You know, if it turns out that this meeting that we have is on Sunday, well, you know, you're there a day earlier, but you'll at least be able to participate in the other events. But in order, you know, to plan your trip and get your plane tickets and everything, I would be safe and plan to be there Saturday morning and just be a little flexible as to when we meet. Do we have, Glenn, a date as to when our presentation will be, or our workshop will be?
No, that hasn't been fixed either yet, Jeff, unfortunately.
Okay, do we have a kind of a time frame as to when we think that might be set?
I think it probably would be on Monday afternoon sometime, or on Wednesday, or maybe even Thursday. I believe the public forum is being pushed around too.
Okay, so I guess we'll kind of play it by ear.
Yes.
Hopefully this will... When do we think that ICANN will be in a position to kind of make sure that the agenda is final? Or do you have any kind of...
I've got no idea. No idea at all, but I'm going to say something which is not very optimistic. There's a board retreat which is on the 20th to the 22nd or somewhere around there of May. And I'm just wondering if everybody is together, if they won't be making some plans there, which is rather late.
Yeah.
But
I guess
lot more optimistic and be next week, but I unfortunately have got no idea.
Okay,
even received the meeting forms yet.
Okay, so hopefully in the coming weeks we'll have a better update for the group.
But I think it's very wise what you say, Jeff, that people should be there on Saturday, because if we have to move around because of Kurt's schedule, it will be much easier.
Okay.
Jeff, this is Monica. A question, for the workshop or the public consultation, is there a day that is preferred over others? I mean, Glenn already mentioned normally the typical days for workshops is, you know, Monday afternoon, Wednesday afternoon, and now I think it looks like Thursday morning might be free as well if the public forum moves in the afternoon. Because, I mean, we can put in a preference. So if, you know, say, look, let's prefer Wednesday over Monday, we can definitely try.
Why don't we put that off the list? I don't have my biggest concern is what it competes with, as opposed to when it is, but I don't know if others have thoughts as well. So why don't we just ask that question on the list?
Well, I mean, then we maybe just leave it open, because I normally try as well, or we can indicate, like, you know, tune conflict, of course, with any other big major workshops. I normally try to, because there are several workshops I'll need to plan in, so it will depend as well on where those are fitted. So, you know, if there's no strong preference, we'll just see as well to make sure that we, you know, get indeed a slot that doesn't compete with any other big major meetings that we know many of GNSO community members will be participating in, so...
Okay. All right, I think with that, I'm not sure there's anything else to discuss. Anyone else have any topics? All right, that said, I will talk to everyone same time next week. And please, oh, I'm sorry, Alan.
Just one comment. At the start of this process, there were some comments that you might have too many opinions to chair this project, and I think, if anything, how you handled the discussion on consensus thresholds indicates we picked the right person. Thank you,
everyone, for the check marks. Alex, you have a comment?
I just wanted also to add my vote of confidence. I think in Jeff sharing, that's all. Thanks.
Thank you guys very much. I've actually enjoyed it. It's been a lot of work keeping on top of everything, but I've certainly learned a lot, and so I thank everyone for that.
It's not over yet.
It's
thank
in some
you
way
all.
It's just beginning. Thank you.
Bye, everyone. Bye, bye.